Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog. We've been off for a little bit. I had some really catastrophic equipment failure going on in my studio. So that plus a bunch of problems with shipping and everything has kept us off the air. I bought this cheap piece of crap microphone, so if my sound quality is not as good as usual, I apologize. Very, very soon I will be getting an upgrade and we'll get some better equipment in here so we can improve audio quality. Because we're professionals, right? We don't like to settle for this kind of crap, but unfortunately we got to settle just so we can bring you guys, the Bog Lords, the content here for you. But if you like The Bog, you support The Bog, make sure to go to patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50, and you get RSS feed of every single show that we do in audio to listen to in the car, at work, or at the gym. If you want to support one of our friends, make sure you go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and check out some authentic Vedic astrology. I'm telling you guys, this stuff is really, really cool. You're going to love him. And if you want to check out our episode we did with him, just go to the Dave Martell YouTube channel, click on playlist, and go scroll down till you find Iron Age Jodish, Mr. Neil John. Great episode. You're going to love it. If you want to support The Bog another way, make sure you go to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop and go check out some of the sweet merch we got over there. Man, White Boy Summer, I've been enjoying White Boy Summer. I've been firing up the grill. It was just my birthday, so we had some, I drank some pina coladas. We fired up the grill. Then the one day we went out for sushi. We went to hibachi. Man, it was great stuff. I've been having so much fun this summer. Yo, it's just wonderful, wonderful time. We got another barbecue coming up this weekend. Before we get the show started, I want to give a shout out. This weekend we are not only celebrating my birthday, my kindred, we're celebrating the 5th year anniversary of my kinsman Shane in his quest for sobriety. So much love, many blessings, many hails to Shane and his victory over his demons that he had in the past. So he's doing very, very good, and we're extremely proud of him. Hail Shane. And I look forward to tearing it up for him this weekend. I think we're going to go to the store after the show's over. I'm going to get some salmon for him. We're going to make some baked mac and cheese, all kinds of stuff. But it's going to be good stuff. But tonight we are going to talk about something that we all love, right? We all love fiction stories, right? Me, personally, growing up, fiction was one of my favorite things. Still is, by the way. I have a Pulp Fiction compilation book coming out. It's going to be published very soon. It's called The Bizarchives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines. And that inspired me to kind of do this show here, where we talk about heathen themes in fiction. Now, we all know, and probably we're going to talk about some of this tonight, stuff like, you know, Lord of the Rings, Conan the Barbarian, your Wheel of Time series, and then you get into some sci-fi stuff. The Dying World or Dying Earth or whatever that was, and then you get into like Wheel of Time. If I didn't, then Wheel of Time. You got all kinds of stuff all over the place. Dune, so many great fiction settings, not just in fantasy and sci-fi, but in more contemporary literature and fiction as well. And there are heathen themes in so many, I guess you could say, pop culture forms of fiction in video games and TV and stuff like that. Now, obviously, we stay away for the most part, away from a lot of the modern crap, right? Because that stuff is just nasty, right? We don't want to watch that stuff. But
no one likes white girl pop culture stuff.
Yeah, nobody likes white girl pop culture garbage. Nobody likes that. But what we do like is stuff that has integrity. A lot of that stuff that came out in the 80s and the 90s and some of the cartoons that we really liked growing up. There's some classic games and stuff that really had themes that speak to us as heathens. Not just like overt, blatant, like mentioning of, you know, Germanic things, but like concepts and ideas and just like messages that speak to us as spiritual people. So we're going to get into that, and we're going to talk about some of our favorite fiction settings that spoke to us on a spiritual level, on a heathen level. And tonight with me, I have Mr. Andre and Mr. Tristan. What's going on, guys?
I'm doing good, Dave.
Excellent. So, Mr. Andre, one of the you mentioned, and this is going to be one that's a little bit unorthodox for a lot of people listening. They probably haven't thought of this or even considered heathen themes in this. And you wanted to talk, firstly, about the game Halo and how you have found heathen themes in that. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's true what you say, though. Most people are probably going to find it surprising, because most people would find it surprising that Halo has any themes at all, except big bad man shoots aliens.
Yeah,
I thought it just had difficulty settings.
The only way to play is heroic. But essentially, Halo has always had a very rich, deep background story going on that is often forgotten. This has expanded itself into animated series and several novels and a lot of different games, not just the main three games, now five. But this has been going on since the year 2000. This is starting to become an old franchise. And thinking back on it, and this became kind of like a little bit of a point of interest for me, because there's always been a lot of religious undertones in Halo. There's always been a lot of mythological undertones as well. But looking more into it, it's starting to emerge like certain concepts here. And I wrote down some of them in order to just emphasize what I think are the core heathen worldviews that you can find in Halo. To just quickly summarize it, part of these big topics that you can find, these big concepts, would be concepts such as fate, loyalty, and honor, and general heroism. So I can just start, just to give a little bit of a background, because this is important for the context of it. This is a very standard science fiction story. This is about 500 years in the future. Humanity has space travel. Humanity finds other worlds. Humans go to these worlds and start building cities. Then humans start having a little bit of a civil war. Everything's normal. Everything's fine. And then suddenly aliens come. That's essentially the background story that you began with. Where it starts getting interesting is because these aliens are, on a fundamental level, religious zealots themselves. They are fanatical worshippers of what they deem as the basically old ones. They are what they call the forerunners, or just gods. The interesting concept here is that humans are also descended from the same type of gods, essentially. They are related to these gods, and the Covenant, as the aliens are called, a mix of several different types of species, view humans as a threat because they are more closely linked to their religion that they like to admit. This ends up in a massive war of extermination against humankind, while simultaneously these aliens trying to use humans to activate these old pieces of technology that are just scattered around the galaxy after these so-called forerunners, because only humans can activate them, and ultimately just eradicate all of humanity. That's basically the main goal of it. Where it starts getting interesting is one of the primary characters, is the primary character of most of the books and the games, and it's Master Chief, also called John 117. He is a standard, pretty bland, honestly, hero figure. He is hero with capital H. He is superhuman. He's not descended directly from gods, as in the case of a lot of these older stories would just say. He is, however, augmented scientifically to be more than human. He seemingly has some sort of supernatural ability as well that they make a big deal out of, that he is incredibly lucky for some reason. He's just overall just a lot more lucky than other people would normally be. And he was raised, he was more or less kidnapped as a child, and he was raised in a brotherhood of warriors that were later known as the Spartans, or the Spartan program, which are, they're basically human space marines. That's what they are. They have augmented bodies, power armor, powerful weapons, all that stuff. And they were made to do specific tasks And he was seen as one of the best, if not the best, amongst all of those. The creator of this program specifically wanted this program to mimic older warrior societies. And the creator, she specifically mentions the Norse Vikings, the Spartans, and the feudal Japanese samurai as inspirations for the culture and the warrior mentality that she wanted to emphasize here. By the way, I know this can be a lot, so if you have any questions, feel free to stop me.
No, that sounds like a... So what part of Halo did you feel there was like a heathen message? Now, obviously, you're talking about the Spartan program that's in the setting there, and that kind of has the feel of maybe like the Yams Vikings, or maybe like the Ulfhednar, the Berserkers, or something like that, like a warrior cult. So,
yes,
what else, like what overarching themes or concepts would you find in this game that appeal to a heathen worldview?
The main gist of it is basically the combination here. This Spartan program, this warrior brotherhood, suffered heavily during the war with these aliens, these religious zealots. But a few of them survived, mainly Master Chief. And he was with humanity from the beginning of the war until the very end, until the bitter end. He was the reason, the single reason, why humanity even survived in the first place. He is an immovable obstacle. He is a mountain. He is a force to be reckoned with, because he can take on entire armies and somehow make it out alive. He can somehow win. He faced down one of the most terrifying enemies that had ever faced in the galaxy and won by outsmarting it, more or less.
So you're saying that you kind of feel as though it is demonstrating or reenacting perhaps the Christianity coming to Europe and kind of stomping out the old heathens, and maybe Master Chief is like one of us, like the last survivors, but he has this heroic, you know, power like Sigurd or Hengist and Horsa or something like that, and he just like, you know, fights to the end.
Yes, and that's an interesting thing, because there's a lot of biblical references in Halo 2, including this immountable threat that I'm talking about. It's called the Flood. It's literally just called the Flood, and it's a parasite. It's a parasitic organism. The thing is, though, it doesn't act like a parasitic organism as it conventionally would, because it tries to talk to you. It tries to reason with you. It tries to tempt you and tell you nice things to try and convince you that ultimately he's right, that this parasite has to exterminate all life in the galaxy because that's the right thing to do. It's evil.
So,
and Master Chief is not buying any of it, and he is fighting until the very bitter end without any regard for his own safety or his own personal gain. He has nothing to gain from this. He was born and raised and trained for war. That's what he does. That's what he's good at. And he fights until the bitter end, expecting nothing. He's actually uncomfortable with the whole hero's return concept. But he realizes that he's a symbol for humanity. He's a symbol for every last dingy little soldier left back on Earth that are fighting a war of extermination for their very survival. And he knows that he's a symbol. He's the only symbol that keeps them safe, that keeps them knowing that there's a chance to win this. And he is willing and able to see it through to the very bitter end. And at the very end, when all things is said and done, he lays down, goes to rest, and just says, "Wake me up when you need me again."
Based. So
that is very based.
Now you mentioned the Flood and how it kind of tries to reason with you, it appeals to your reason. Would you attribute this to like maybe Christian apologetics, or would you put that more with like liberalism, modern liberalism?
It's almost more like it's a liberalism, because it has been explicitly stated in universe that part of this Flood hive mind, as it's called, because they're controlled by a hive mind, is that they are running on a extremely like socialistic, almost communistic system of equality. Despite being a basic primitive organism, it can be very intelligent. And what is later revealed is that the creator of both humans and the Forerunners, as I mentioned previously, called the Precursors — I'm not giving them any bonus points for the names they chose here — but the Precursors ended up in a war with the Forerunners, because the Forerunners got jealous of humanity because the precursors told humanity that they were the true heirs of the galaxy. The Forerunners decided to attack the precursors, exterminate them, then attack humanity and break humanity down into the Stone Age again before they ultimately ended up having to fight a war against the Flood that they lost and had to exterminate all life in the galaxy in order to prevent the Flood from spreading. Thing is, the Flood was never a real just organism. It was a creation. It was a punishment sent from the precursors to the Forerunners. Humans were immune to it, more or less. It was not designed to kill them. It was designed to kill the Forerunners only.
See, when you first mentioned the Flood, the first thing that came to my mind was dealing with hordes of Lokians.
Essentially that, but what the aliens are the more Lokian here, because the aliens are playing a dangerous, subversive game where they know what is happening. They know that what they're preaching is downright dangerous, and it's revealed that the alien leadership of the Covenant is led by a priestly class of weak, degenerate, frail-looking aliens called the Sanshiyum, or just the Prophets, who manipulate their way into politics and just use their position of power to just be debauched and subversive and sneaky. They play other species up against each other to prevent them from rising up and so forth. Lokian.
I have never heard anyone ever do that. Like, degenerate hedonistic politicians. All of our ruling classes are swell people.
They hire mercenaries that are treacherous to a T. Like, they are only in it for the cash and the money. They have a slave race underneath them that are browbeaten and broken. They don't even have much of a home world left because they were disobedient once, because they were tired of getting their eggs exterminated. And underneath them, you have another race of very tall, reptilian-looking creatures. They're obviously alien. They're obviously meant to be kind of, like, evil-looking, but at the same time, they have a begrudging respect towards humanity and the Spartans, especially the Spartans, which they nicknamed affectionately as the Demon, because that's what he was in the religion, essentially. But they have a great respect for him because they are a very martial race. Ultimately, these reptilian aliens, known as the Sangheili, were betrayed, thrown away, and then later joined with humanity to defeat first the Covenant and then defeat the Flood. All of this made possible by Master Chief, who was the unifier amongst them. He was the one who earned the aliens' trust to begin with to finish the fight, essentially.
So yeah, there's certainly a lot of themes of heroism and self-sacrifice and fate and stuff like that. And we're probably going to mention fate probably 20 more times tonight. But I kind of wanted to move over to Tristan. And Tristan wanted to talk about, he wanted to talk about a couple. He's got another unorthodox one, and then he has one that just needs to be mentioned.
Right. I guess we'll go with the first one that everyone needs to mention, and it's right off the bat, is Lord of the Rings. So I'm not even going to try to explain to people the story of Lord of the Rings, because I assume everyone knows it, and if you don't, then you simply can't be helped at this point. But I will go through some of the less known references and connections to Germanic culture and mythology and themes that people might not have actually realized themselves. To start with, we have to realize that Tolkien himself was the professor of Anglo-Saxon at Oxford University, and so he was himself professionally familiar with and conversant in Germanic mythology. He himself wrote a translation of Beowulf, and he put a whole bunch of different references and some outright just old yank stories from Germanic myth to just put it wholesale into Lord of the Rings. The entire idea of the Lord of the Rings actually stems from the German play Der Ring des Nibelungen, which was a loose retelling of the story of Sigurd Dragonslayer in the Volsunga saga. And it's about a magic ring that grants its wielder the power to rule the entire world. Obviously, we see how that goes into the Lord of the Rings bit. Mm-hmm. But some of the lesser known references are things like the scene in which Gandalf and the Balrog of Moria fight against this bridge in in the mines there, and they struggle, and the bridge crumbles. And this is thought to represent the Balrog is representing Surtur as he breaks the Bifrost during when Ragnarok first begins.
Oh wow! I didn't know that.
Right. It seems like one of those things where as soon as you say it, you realize, oh, you're right. That seems like that should be it. One of the other things is that the mythology of Lord of the Rings, there's actually gods and everything going on in the background. And these gods are referred to as the Einar and the Valar, which are obvious references to the Aesir and the Vanir, of course. Another really good one, this is actually almost directly taken from Germanic myth, is that the first of the elves is named Ingwe Ingwerran, which is his name means chief of chieftain, and he's the lord of the elves. And his name is, of course, derived from the god Yngvifrer, who is himself prince of Alfheim.
Wow.
Yeah, so another reference here is that, and this is one of my personal favorites because I really dig the Rohirrim, is the Rohirrim trace their kingly lineage back to a man called Errol the Young, who is a direct reference to basically the Rigstula. He is the entire Rigstula. He's Conn the Younger, effectively. His father was named Leod, and he was the chieftain of the Aethiod, which are the people, the clan that the Rohirrim stem from. They lived far to the north near the source of the Anduin River. And when Errol was 16 years old, his father Leod was killed by a wild horse that he had tried to tame. And for this act, the horse was named Mansbane. So Errol hunted the horse, and rather than kill him, he required that the horse serve him and surrender his freedom as a Vergild price. So the horse submitted to Errol, and he named him Felleroth. And Felleroth became Errol's steed and was the father of the Merus, which were like demigod horses. If you watch like the movies, Gandalf has a specific horse that he calls over and over again, and he is one of the Merus. They're basically the best horses in Middle-earth, effectively. And it was said that no other person could ever ride Felleroth because it would only allow Errol the Young to ride him. An interesting reference here is also that Rohan's royal house has a tradition of having an Eo name to them, like Eomer and Eowyn, Eodin, Eomund. And this is a reference to the fact that the Elder Futhark ring, generally known as Eowas, which actually means horse, in Anglo-Saxon, the rune was called Eo. And so you see Eomer, Eowyn, they're all the horse folk.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, Lord of the Rings is just littered with some of these references and stories. I mean, the Leod himself was thought to be a descendant of Fram the Dragon Slayer, which is basically just a straight up pastiche of Sigurd the Dragon Slayer again. Like, you know, when you go into the real depths of the backstories of Lord of the Rings, it's absolutely chock full of Germanic references, and I would highly recommend anyone at all go into it and read it. It's remarkable prose, and it would definitely speak to your soul, which is exactly the point that Tolkien was trying to do when he wrote it.
Yeah. Just like reading it or watching the movies is just completely, it just, there's a reason that pretty much every heathen loves Lord of the Rings, right? It's just, we all do. And it's just the overarching theme of the story just like sings to us in our worldview, and that is simple people rising up against an overarching evil to stop effectively, you know, Ragnarok coming. And then look at the bad guys in there, the orcs. What do they talk about with the orcs? That they destroy the forests with industry and all this stuff. They're like the capitalists or the communists, or they're like the modern industrialists coming in and destroying life of agrarian tradition.
That's exactly what they are, is the modern industrialization destroying the green and pretty land that was England, as far as Tolkien was concerned.
Well, isn't there also a case with the Tolkien universe that the orcs themselves are not even creations? They're just mere parodies and mockeries of actual creations.
Right, because only Eru Ilúvatar had the power of actual creation. So Morgoth, when he rebelled against him, he effectively just twisted elves into orcs.
So they are a corruption of good, essentially.
Right. That's one of the major themes of Lord of the Rings, is that evil has no actual creative energy or life of its own. It can only subsist from corrupting the actual goodness and life that already exists.
And that is a very heathen thing. Yeah, the idea that that which is godly has the power to create, because that which is godly has inspiration. So it's like we create, the gods create, we have inspiration. However, that which is wicked does not. It can only consume, like the orcs when they're chopping down all the trees and building their industry and creating their army to further destroy. They can only consume and destroy. Whereas that which is good has the ability to create and live in harmony with nature and natural law and stuff like that.
Another major heathen theme there is that because of they're so corrupted by evil, the orcs turned ugly and misshapen and brutal looking. And it's actually a very common ancient tradition to equate goodness itself with beauty and vice versa. The good is the beautiful and the beautiful is the good.
Yeah, and that which is ugly is misshapen by corruption.
Right, exactly. People believed that if someone was particularly ugly, disgusting to look at, that sort of thing, it betokened a spiritual corruption within their soul.
Wow. Isn't there like a whole thing, isn't there like a science word for that, that people that are ugly are usually... like, have bad temperaments and...
Oh, like, physiognomy.
Is that what that's called? Like, an ugly guy is going to have lower IQ and be...
Well, it's the idea that you could justify and explain certain behaviors, like criminality and IQ and stuff like that, based on certain facial features that people have and, you know, the way they look like. And generally stuff like that, where if people are very... beautiful and good looking with straight, nice proportioned features, they're going to be well kept members of society, polite and industrious and good, that sort of thing.
Well,
I mean, you don't quote me on it, but I do believe I've heard once that people with asymmetrical faces have a greater tendency towards crime.
Yeah,
they do, actually.
Yeah, I read that study. There's a study that people with that are more symmetrical have higher IQs. People that are taller have higher IQs, whereas people that are shorter and have asymmetrical faces have lower IQs and are more likely to commit acts of aggression or violence.
Man, let's wrecked.
Well, that's like, you know, that's not saying that all tall guys are awesome and all short guys are garbage. What's that saying is that people that are shorter, that's probably an indicator of malnutrition or something of that nature. You know what I mean?
Well, no, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, the people with good, desirable genes that you would want to breed with are also the people that give really good results, like being intelligent and strong and industrious and polite and charitable. All these things are virtues for a reason, because they were kept in good quality things that people wanted to have within their bloodline.
Very good. So is there anything else you'd like to touch on with Lord of the Ring? I know we could be here. We could do a whole episode about the
I could literally just go on and on. So I just wanted to throw a few things out there. We can go on to your next one.
So I'm going to throw one out that's not necessarily it's not something that has a lot of... It's not like a piece of classical literature. It's not something that you're probably going to think that we would bring up on this show, but it's something that spoke to me as a contemporary heathen, as a modern heathen, and that is the show The Sopranos. And I just got done watching it again because I love mafia stuff. I'm a big fan of it. I think it's like American classic westerns. You know, I mean, it's just like it's. Everything from the Godfather, which is arguably the best movie ever made, versus, like, you know, then you get into stuff like Goodfellas and you know, so on and so forth. We all know all the great mafia movies. Everybody's seen them. Everybody likes them, except Andre. He's never seen Godfather. So everybody in the chat, shame Andre for never watching The Godfather.
Way to call me out, Dave.
I was just telling him the other day that he should really watch The Sopranos.
Sopranos is great. Sopranos is a little bit different than some of the other mafia movies in that The Sopranos is a little bit more on a personal level. It shows what a modern like mob boss is going through in modernity. And this spoke to me as a heathen, and I believe that once we talk about this, I think a lot of heathens, if they go back and watch The Sopranos, will feel this as well. And Sopranos was a show. It came out on HBO. I would never suggest anybody go watch anything that comes out on HBO now. You know, but The Sopranos is a little raunchy. It's not something you want to watch in front of your kids. It's got, you know, nudity and sexual themes and drugs and stuff like that in there. It is
violence.
What's that?
Oh, I was saying it's got lots of violence. People are getting killed left, right, and center.
Yeah, it is an adult show. It is an adult show. But The Sopranos appealed to me as a heathen because, first of all, it's a show that came out, I believe, in 1998 or something like that, and ran until like 2006. It had pretty much almost seven seasons, and it is the story of the mobsters in New Jersey. Whereas, you know, when we talk about mobsters, when you watch mobster movies, it's always about one of the five families of New York. It's always one of the big guys, right? It never shows any of these other kinds of little mafia crews that were around throughout history, which is there's crews in Philly, crews in Buffalo, crews in, you know, down in Florida. There's like some in out in California and stuff like that. And it shows a smaller family, mafia family, that existed in North New Jersey, which is, for people that are familiar with the geography of the East Coast, New Jersey is like right across the bridge from New York City. North Jersey is right across the bridge from New York City. South Jersey is right across the bridge from Philadelphia. It's pretty much where it is. The state of New Jersey is pretty much where those two cities go to take a crap. It's like, you know, it's not like a place you would think that there would be this prolific mafia family. And they're not a prolific mafia family. They're kind of like, there's actually one scene where they're described as this, they're like, you know, we got the five families here in New York, and then we got this pygmy monstrosity over there in Jersey pretending like they're one of us. That's what they're talking about, these guys. But this,
see, I always found it really funny in The Sopranos because the entire time before you really start dealing with the other mafia families, you're kind of led to believe that they're like top shit, right? Like these are super mafia guys. They portray themselves as that way. They're super into the culture in the background. And then you suddenly realize, oh, right, these guys are like laughing stocks of these other bigger guys who don't even like them.
Yeah, exactly. So what it goes through is effectively, first of all, why it appealed to me. The first thing that I noticed is, the mafia, which is called La Cosa Nostra, means our thing. And our thing is kind of like, that means their thing that they do. This is our thing that we do. What do heathens call our meetings, our sacred meetings, our places of worship and law and things like that? Things, right? You go to the thing. So it was like, that's not necessarily connected, but that kind of was like, hey, that's a little bit of, that sounds similar to me. So I get in and,
well, I mean,
go ahead.
I mean, not only that, but I mean, the way our ancestors referred to their religion was literally just the ancient customs. They didn't even really have a word for it. It's just the thing that we do.
Yeah, so it was our thing. Heathenry is our thing. La Cosa Nostra is Tony Soprano's thing. That was the mafia's thing. So what I noticed right away, why this appeals to me as a heathen, is number one, their clannishness. You know, they operate versus modern society. Sopranos is really the only mafia show that shows this, how the old way of doing La Cosa Nostra, of doing old traditional style of organization, is in these multi-family units. These units of multiple families that are bonded either by marriage or by oath. You know, when you go into the mafia, you swear an oath, and you become a member of that family. You become a member of that clan. And that's how we as heathens do it. We really do. So it's like they have this little piece of history, this traditional clan hierarchy that is encapsulated in this microcosm within all of modern society all around them, and they have the struggles of trying to maintain that and operate with that, whereas outside society to them looks kind of alien. And I felt that. You know, me as a modern heathen, when I tell people that are out in modernity about my kindred or my clan or how we as heathens operate, they're like, oh, what are you, in a cult? They can't even fathom a clan. Whereas, you know, probably just like a couple centuries ago, it was just commonplace. Everybody did it. But now in modernity, the idea of even being attached to your just basic nuclear family is weird to moderns, to modern people. Whereas us, we have these huge, you know, not huge, sometimes huge, but these multi-family organizational units that are tied by both marriage and or oath. A lot of times, oath. And when you watch Sopranos, you know, Paulie walks in, or Silvio walks in, or one of these people walk in, the kids are like, Uncle Paulie, Uncle Silvio. When my kinsmen come over, it's, hey, Uncle Shane, Uncle Seth, Uncle this. They're my kids' uncles, aunts and uncles. So it's like we operate in this same kind of clannishness. So although, yes, they are kind of Sicilian, South Italian culture, they're not Germanic culture, but it is very, very interesting to see a clan structure struggling against modernity as we do. And I very much, the character of Tony Soprano on a personal level, I feel it. You know what I mean? I feel him as a character. He has these temper tantrums. He's kind of thrusted into this position of leadership that he kind of has to figure out along the way. He's got a lot of people that trust in him and lean on him, and he's like, you know, he's not trained for it. He didn't have a manual. He just kind of wound up there. And he's a guy he's a wheeling and dealing guy. He's got a big charisma, a lot of jokes, very well liked. He's a guy that's very, you know, he's very masculine. He's kind of short-tempered. But he's somebody that also deeply, deeply loves his family, but sees the outside world as something for him to rip off, right? He has dual morality. These mafia guys, they have dual morality as heathens do. You know, we don't see, you know, the Valha. We don't see the outside society as people that are awarded our love and our social etiquettes and stuff like that. You know, what does it say? If your neighbor is thy enemy, trade lie for a lie so that spears may not be drawn and all that stuff. They are outsiders. And that's how it is in Sopranos as well. Another thing that I found very, as a heathen, what I sympathized with a lot in the show The Sopranos is just how raw it displays the tragedy that working class white people have to deal with. You know, the drug overdoses, the addictions, the violence, the jail time, and stuff like that. Now, obviously, it's Hollywood. It's entertainment, so it's over the top. But how many people do we know in the heathen community that have lost a child or lost a brother or a sister or a cousin or a dear friend to drugs? How many of us know somebody that's been to jail? How many of us know somebody that did something dumb and gambled away too much money? Like, how many of us know the struggles of, you know, the white working class in modernity? Because let's face it, heathenry, we are overwhelmingly working class, right? I mean, there's those of us out there that are financially on higher, you know, economic levels and stuff like that. But overwhelmingly, we're blue collar folk, man. That's who we are. And you know, historically, it's how we've always been. You know, when Christianity came to town, it was, you know, who stayed with the heathen tradition. It was farmers. It was the guys that worked the heath. That's why we're heathens, right? So that was something that I really sympathized with in watching The Sopranos. And probably the biggest thing that I felt as a modern heathen that I saw in Sopranos that I really, really felt was, I mentioned before about how they, as a mafia crew, are kind of encapsulated in this like this place where old traditions and stuff still reign supreme in this traditional hierarchy where modernity is just all around them and they struggle with it. And Tony, as the character, as the main character, you know, he goes to this psychiatrist or psychologist or whatever she is, and that's like a theme throughout the show. And he has to deal with these realities in modernity that he just finds absolutely bizarre. Stuff about homosexuals, stuff with you know, people being weird and drugs, and just the idea of going to the psychiatrist in the beginning was a big hush hush. Right? You know, it was like he kept it under wraps, and it got out because his mom found out about it. You know, his son mentioned it to his mom, and his mom's like, Tony's seeing a psychiatrist? No. And they go through, they have this big scene where she just couldn't believe that he's going to see a psychiatrist. And it's pretty base. She goes, a psychiatrist? Everybody knows that's a racket for the Jews. So she says, but anyway, there are so many of these, like, these things that are taboo in their little traditional culture that modernity is like, what are you guys freaking out about? You know, and thing, there's a part where one of the characters, Uncle Junior, he's completely embarrassed because it comes out that he, you know, performs oral sex on his mistress. And to them, that's gay stuff. If you do that, you're gay. You know what I mean? If you do that, you might as well do the other thing with a guy. So you can't be trusted. You got to go. So they have to kind of like navigate modernity with these very traditional worldviews. And I really sympathize with that. Because when I hear modern people talking about, you know, just the weird stuff that they're into, they do, it just sounds absolutely bizarre and alien to me because I am in an insulated, traditional, heathen community. I am encapsulated in this community, and I have to struggle, all of us, I think everybody listening here can feel this. We have to struggle with modernity traveling all around us as it crashes down into the pits of depravity, and we are kind of, you know, in this little encapsulation of traditionalism. Andrew the Beard says you just like Sopranos because they're Italian, and yeah, well, I feel that a little bit too. You know, I like seeing them eating all the food and hearing the music and, you know, the stuff that reminds me.
They got the gabagool.
They got the gabagool. Yeah, they got the capicola. They're eating the prosciutto. You know, they're always munching on pasta, and you know, you got the Zeppelis and the cannolis and all that stuff. And yeah, sure, that reminds me of my family. But that's not the main reason. The main reason I feel, as a heathen, I sympathize with the show The Sopranos is for what I just mentioned, right? Because what happens if, and you guys out there that are in a kindred, if you guys find out that somebody in your kindred is a closeted homosexual, what are you going to do?
Well, to quote Polly, he got to go.
Yeah. He's got to go, T. He's got to go. But, you know, in our kindreds, unfortunately, you know, because of our faith, if somebody comes up with that kind of lifestyle, we have to exclude them, right? We have to, you know, exclude them. But modernity looks at us like we're nuts because of that. How dare you? What's wrong with that? We're not even going to get into, you know, having these kinds of people around kids and all that. But, you know, I sympathize with The Sopranos showing a mafia La Cosa Nostra in modernity as things rapidly change and decay, and they are still encapsulated in a traditional worldview. And that's my take on Sopranos as a heathen.
Well, if I can add to that, I actually have like a fairly historical example, as I've been recently watching another historical show myself.
Go ahead.
And it's called Black Sails, and it's basically just about the pirates in the Pirate Republic of Nassau, if people are familiar with that. And it's very similar to what you were talking about, actually, in that these privateers, as they were called, basically hired by England and so forth as legal pirates, and then at the drop of a hat, they were no longer hired, but they were left in a place that they didn't really know or were unfamiliar with, and they were not welcome back. They were not welcome back to their own world. And these people, these pirates, as they were now known, were the lowest of the low. They were outsiders in their own communities and their own countries. These people had countries that in the form of their ships, essentially. And they realized that they were the lowest of the low of society, and as a result, they wanted to bind together. They wanted to keep their way of life. They wanted to keep their traditions alive, and they realized it was them against the entire world. And they resisted any sort of occupation or cooperation with these old powers in Europe when they were ravaging the Caribbean. And as a result, they ended up having to set up the so-called Pirate Republic of Nassau, which were successful in some regards, but ultimately did fail. Excuse me. But it's interesting that you mentioned it, because like this kind of conflict, this mentality of these outsiders, these outlaws, essentially, or being pushed into being outlaws because they were on the fringes of society, they wanted to just bind together and create something of themselves because they realized they were not welcome in the modern world. They had traditions, they had their ways that they wanted to keep.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to mention The Sopranos, you know, one more time, it's one thing that's really interesting to me is, you know, like heathenry, La Cosa Nostra has these like oaths and values that are just blatantly not compatible with modernity, and they have to deal with that a lot. Modern people don't understand the idea of you know, values that are external to one's desires. You know, there's so many times where, you know, the wives of these guys, they're like, well, why don't we just go, let's just go into witness protection and just get out of here and leave. And they're like, no, I can't leave. This is an oath. You don't just quit this, you know? And that's something that modern people struggle to understand when I explain heathenry to them. If one of my kinsmen calls me at 2 a.m, I have to go help them. If they call me when I'm at work and there's an emergency, I gotta go. You know? There's things that it's just you can't change. It's not up for negotiation. You take an oath, you live and you die by that oath, because that is external from you. When you become a heathen, you come into service to the holy gods. And that, then it's like, you know, your life is no longer yours. It belongs to the gods. It belongs to your folk. It belongs to your children. It belongs to the nation. You serve the gods and the nation and your people. It's not about, you know, what you want anymore. And modern people, their religion is what I want, what I desire, what makes me feel good, what gives me pleasure. So when they are confronted with somebody that has that, they can't understand it. It's just completely alien to them. So that was another thing.
You know, an interesting point to raise here is actually that the origins of the Mafia itself are thought to stem all the way back to the ancient Roman collegia, which were basically gangs of organized criminals, thieves and stuff, that often took their roots from retiring soldiers and ex-soldiers who basically formed a sort of military brotherhood in order to police and control their own territories within the city and help their own people.
Yeah.
I mean, again, that sounds exactly like what the pirates were doing as well. And this was in the 15th to the 1700s. So this is a very old concept.
People get very angry at me for it, but I've always argued for the position that, in some extents, the criminal and the warrior are very closely related soul aspects.
I mean, it should be said, though, that even, like, in terms of any sort of like mafia and so forth, like, they have a very strict code of conduct. They have brotherhood. They have oaths of loyalty. And for our own religion, we know that oaths are very serious business, and oath breaking is probably one of the, if not the most heinous of crimes that you can ever commit. Breaking an oath is basically a shortcut to the worst kind of life and afterlife you can possibly imagine.
Yeah. It's
I mean, it's all based in the Manor Boon concept, right? Where you have your network of brothers and yourself and you're loyal to them. And really, it's basically just a sort of one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. We could say that one man's war band is another man's band of thieving criminals.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. It's like Andre said, oath breaking is very, very serious stuff. The only reason it's not strictly punished in modernity is because of modernity, because we don't have that freedom. But if this was a heathen society, oath breakers would be executed. That's not a joke. That's true.
Well, you know, even in modern society, it's still illegal to lie under oath. It's perjury.
Well, I guess it's more like in the case of more personal oaths, like if you swear an oath towards a friend and you break that oath, you're not going to get persecuted for it. You're not even most likely not going to be looked down upon for doing so either. Which is why it's kind of interesting to see these organized criminal bands have laws of their own. They operate on a law set that's entirely their own, where oath breaking and so forth is incredibly harshly punished. I mean, like, even something as unfamiliar and as strange, you see this all over the world. Like, for instance, the Yakuza, any sort of, like, broken promises and so forth is punished with the cutting off the little finger in order to remind you of the fact that you've actually broken a promise. It's a permanent reminder that you're not going to mess around anymore. Because if you mess around anymore, they're not just going to take the finger, they're going to take your head.
Yeah.
So, Dave, here's actually a pretty good question in the chat from Statutory Grape. What if you swear an oath to a kindred member's child, then the parent is ostracized from the kindred? I've been wondering that.
That's a tough call. It's a tough call. It depends how ostracized. You know, were they... But, you know, it's like your oath to the child stands. Your oath to the child stands. So if that child at some point calls you and says, hey, I need help with this, or I'm in trouble, or something like that, you have to help the child. Your oath is to that child. But if, it's also a gray area, because it's like, if the kindred member is expelled from the kindred, they and their house are also expelled. So they are sort of not even part of the clan anymore. So it's a gray area. It's a gray area. I would talk to your Gothi. I would talk to your Gothi or your alderman about how to handle that.
I think it also matters how old the child actually is. For instance, if they're an adult or effectively an adult, I would think it's kind of like ostracizing someone's uncle and then still letting them be a part of the kindred, right?
Yeah. So it's just it's tough. It's tough. It's a hard situation. I can't really rule on it without, you know, I would say talk to your Gothi or talk to your alderman to see how they would want to handle something like that.
I mean, I have to agree with Dave here, though, that honestly, at the end of the day, it's more of a personal oath. If you have sworn a personal oath towards the child, you're more or less kind of obliged to uphold it unless there is other circumstances involved. Because it's, I would almost say that there is almost a little bit of a difference between a personal oath and a person swearing an oath to a kindred or an organization or something like that. Even if the parents of said child fall out of favor with the organization, you have still kind of sworn a personal oath towards that person, that child in this case, where unless they do something really egregious, you should still try your best in order to sway them towards, I guess, your own protection if their parents that have been shunned from the community, probably with good reasons. The child should not necessarily be responsible or held responsible for the sins of the father.
And then Andrew the Beard says the adult is a piece of shit, though not the child. Yeah, and that's certainly something that an alderman faced with this dilemma should take into consideration, in my opinion. It's tough. That's a tough situation. You could say that the child is part of that house collective, and therefore the entirety of the house is expelled, and therefore oaths are dissolved. You could also say that that you're absolutely right, that the adult is ostracized, but the child had no part in it, so therefore oaths to the child stand. So it's, if an alderman like ruled either way, I wouldn't like make a stand against. I wouldn't counter signal them. That's a tough decision, and I do not envy any sort of clan leader that has to make a ruling on something like that.
It's a very tough decision, and actually, I would even say personally that it's almost inappropriate for the child to be part of the kindred if the father was ostracized, because it's like he's turning his back on his own immediate blood kin in favor of the collective. Me and Andre were talking about something rather similar. I won't go into the details there, but it's a very Germanic custom that a family sticks together and doesn't, you know, they may fight internally, but they don't betray each other. They don't leave cracks in the kin fence in order to allow outsiders to penetrate and ruin the family.
Yeah, any sort of disagreement between family members stays between family members in the four walls of the house. It does not leak on the outside.
Yeah, so, it's a tough discussion. It's, as I mentioned before, an alderman could with the, as far as the situation of a father being ostracized and oaths to the child, that's something I would leave up to. That's something I would leave up to the individual, you know, leaders of that kindred to discern. And my heart, my prayers go out to anybody that has to make a ruling of that nature, because it's tough. There's no right answer there. It's just, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would actually have to just agree with both of my co-hosts here and say that at the end of the day, you should default to the leadership of your own kindred, preferably the Gothi.
Yeah. Anything else from the chat?
No, it looks like that's more or less going on here.
All right, very good. All right, folks, that's going to be it for this evening. We left a lot on the table. I rambled on about the Sopranos for way too long. But it's all good. It's all good. Maybe we'll do a part two of this later on so we could talk about some other stuff. I was going to talk about some video games. I had some video games I wanted to talk about as far as heathen themes in them. We wanted to talk about... We actually missed out. We were going to talk about Final Fantasy VII and Dragon Ball Z and Warhammer 40K. But we'll get to it next time.
I find it kind of amusing we missed out on literally half of our stuff, so we should definitely do a part two.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll absolutely do a part two. So much love and many blessings to each and every one of you guys. Like always, we're going to raise the horn to our most exalted patrons, Mr. Corey and our very own Andre from Norway. Hails and blessings to them, and hails and blessings to each and every one of you guys. For those of you that still are doing the solar calendar, Midsummer is coming up. So I know some folks are doing their Midsummer this weekend or the following weekend. And man, I hope you guys have a wonderful, wonderful Midsummer, you folks that are doing it this weekend. Like I said, I'm doing I got a little event going on this weekend for a guy in my kindred that is celebrating 5 years of sobriety. So, everybody put in the chat, hail Shane, to celebrate him and his victory over addiction. And we are going to be raising horns in his honor, this weekend, non-alcoholic horns in his honor this weekend. And, we're going to fire up the grill for my birthday. So it should be a good time as White Boy Summer continues on. But if you want to get geared up for White Boy Summer, don't forget to go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. It gets you guys a cool muscle shirt, artisan chef apron. We got little cups like mason jar cups that have ice in it. You can put your ice in it, put your pina coladas or your beer or whatever. Whatever you got, you can put it in there for when you're chilling with your boys out by the grill, grilling up some salmon, some barbecue pork chops, some ribs, some burgers, whatever you got. You know, hail to the grill dads out there. But if you want to become a frequent supporter of The Bog and help us keep the lights on and keep the show going, make sure you go to patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. And then you can get the RSS feed of audio of every single show that we do to listen to at work, at the gym, or in your car. That is patreon.com/TheBog. And if you like us, you want to support one of our friends, make sure you go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. I'm telling you guys, this stuff is so cool. But if you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell them Big Dave sent you. Tell them Big Dave sent you. But anyway, that's going to be it for this evening. I'll see you guys next Monday here on The Bog on Dave Martell YouTube channel, 6 p.m. Eastern. Many hails, many blessings to all the Bog Lords out there. I'll see you next time. Hail.